This is Profiles in Risk. Hosted by Nick Lamparelli. Every week, we interview those who risk life, limb, fortunes, career, and reputation, and those who work behind the scenes who look to protect and enlighten us about risk. You can find the show notes and other insurance-related content at insnerds.com. That's insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Profiles in Risk. I'm your host, Nick Lamparelli. I am pleased today to introduce Steve Evans. Steve is the owner and editor-in-chief of both Artemis, a media site dedicated to the insurance-linked securities market, and Reinsurance News, a media site dedicated to current events around the reinsurance markets. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Nice to talk to you.
We've never spoken before, but I feel like I know you because I feel like you've written for me. I've read so many of your articles. I believe one of your articles was the first thing I ever retweeted on Twitter.
Exactly what I want to hear.
So yeah, that's how far back we go together. So I already feel like I know you, but this is actually the first time we're talking. And in fact, you didn't actually come from reinsurance or insurance. You came from somewhere else. Before we jump into your publications, can you talk about where you came from and how you got into this mess?
Sure. I mean, I guess I really came from the internet world, but it was the very early days of the internet when people had grand ideas about being able to catalog the whole thing. And that's essentially what we tried to do. In 1995, I joined a startup, and everything we did was actually for the insurance industry, the risk industry, and other financial markets. But we had this grand idea of cataloging what was useful on the internet in the way of research, in the way of news, in the way of information for the insurance industry. That startup, we did a number of quite innovative things, as well as building sort of the first websites for any of the Lloyd's of London syndicates, because this was the mid-90s, so it's the early days of the internet, and we were one of the only people targeting that sector. We also built the world's first online weather derivatives exchange in, I think it was 1997 or 8, and that was obviously very early days for any sort of financial trading technology online as well. And we also did some very clever things around personal injury claims, predictors for the Law Society in the UK. We built very useful tools that went out and scoured the internet for sort of legal and compliance related issues on brands. And one of the things we did was build an enormous portal called the Risk Information Services Exchange, which we launched in 1996. And come 1996 to 97, the first catastrophe bonds appeared. And so out of that, we span Artemis in late 1998 because the catastrophe bond area was one that we wanted to focus on more. So actually my background originally was as a researcher. That very quickly changed into being an internet developer and designer. And that very quickly changed into managing information portals, building relationships with this industry, and so on from there. That was kind of the early days. I was very lucky that my boss at the time, the owner of that startup, was somebody who's now very influential in the industry, and I learned an enormous amount from him in that time.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Actually, like everything that you started to rattle off actually became big and important in insurance. Cataloging, searching, exchanges. Like you had like the right instincts early on about where this was potentially going. And so it sounds like Artemis itself, which is the go-to source. I don't know of anything else that's even remotely close to providing the amount of information for insurance-linked securities. So are you saying Artemis was sprouted as a way to begin to catalog and keep and be a source of information for catastrophe bonds?
Absolutely. It was it was kind of late 96 when we saw the first catastrophe bond sort of coming to market, I guess. But we already had this idea that the capital markets would play a much bigger role in insurance risk transfer. There was a very clear understanding that the the peak exposures that the industry faces are so huge that the pool of capital within the industry is probably not enough to deal with those on its own. And so diversifying the risk out to a new source of capital was seen as a very valuable thing to do, and hence a lot of the sponsors of the early cap bonds were very big companies. There was no discussion of efficiency or cost of capital at the time. It was all about securing access to the deepest and most liquid pool of capital available, with the vision that one day risk itself would become liquid within that pool as well.
I think we're going to spend a lot of the second half of the podcast talking about the markets themselves and where they're going. So that makes Artemis about 20 years old.
Just about.
So you have now, you're celebrating some milestones. Can you briefly talk about each of them?
Sure. So Artemis began as just as you said, a catalog of the information that was available that we had on the marketplace, plus sort of links to research publications, plus directories of contact details for people who are involved in what was an extremely niche market at the time. I can remember when we launched Artemis, we were happy with about 200 readers a month. Nowadays, if I have less than that by 8 a.m. in the morning, I'm extremely disappointed.
So, yeah. So
things have changed quite slightly there. But yeah, it's coming up to 20 years since Artemis was initially launched. It was actually launched in Bermuda, despite the fact Artemis has actually always been run out of the UK. And I'm based in the southern part of the UK right now. But it was launched in Bermuda to an audience of reinsurance industry executives at an event there. And so yeah, nearly 20 years ago. Artemis was owned by my employer at the time, but I actually became the owner of Artemis in about 2004, I think it was. But then it spent a couple of years sort of in the doldrums because I had other career activities on the go at the time. But I always kept it as a bit of a side project. And then 10 years ago this month, actually just last week, I installed a copy of WordPress on the website and decided I'd have a go at writing some articles for the industry. Now, not coming from a journalistic background at all, that seemed like a quite alien thing at the time, but now roughly 9,933, I think it is, articles ago. Artemis today has approximately anywhere from 40,000 to 45,000 readers every month. So we've grown quite considerably in that time.
Okay, so now my curiosity is taking over, being a blogger as well. You know, it's a side project. Yours was a side project. So when did it stop becoming a side project? What were the key indicators that told you, I'm scratching something here that's bigger than what I thought it was going to be? I need to devote all of my energies to this.
Sure. I mean, I went through about sort of 8 years where I worked in e-commerce for large companies ranging from lastminute.com to Virgin to Expedia and the likes. And in that time, Artemis was either something I updated at weekends just to keep the catalog of information up to date with deals. Or I had relationships with people in the industry still. And I could just tell that there was a groundswell of opinion and activity beginning to build. I guess in the sort of mid-2000s that sort of suggested to me that this was a market that was ripe for expansion. And to be honest, I've thought the market was ripe for expansion since as long ago as 97, 98. I thought back then, everybody's going to have a cat bond in their reinsurance program. Took a bit longer than that. But yeah, so I could see that there was the potential. I could see that this was a very niche market. I could also see that I have an approach to business-to-business publishing that maybe differs a little bit to other publishers in the space, in that I'm really trying to create the largest awareness of the industry and the largest audiences possible, the most relevant audiences, obviously, importantly, and finding ways to monetize that. So I guess the turning point for me was probably about a year or so after I began writing articles for the site. And at the time, I was actually just a consultant to a number of financial companies and also to e-commerce companies. So I was working kind of freelance, had a bit of time on my hands. So I put a bit more effort into rebuilding and building the awareness of Artemis at the time. And that was going quite well. And I guess the tipping point was probably when somebody contacted me and said, hey, we think you've got a great platform. We think we'd like to maybe advertise on it. And this was a company who never advertises anywhere, never spends money anywhere, but they were keen to be associated with something they saw as positive for the sector, I guess.
Well, that's an important signal, right? I would have taken it the same way. So please don't make me jealous here or envious of your ability to work, but how do you get information? Your site it's so broad, it's global. Please tell me you have a team of like 1,000 people capturing all that information, because there is a ton there. And so how do you curate information? How do you stay global? How do you stay relevant with considering that the industry has exploded so rapidly in all different kinds of directions? How do you manage all of that information?
I think it's two things. One is about having good relationships with people in the industry, which I have so many friends I've built up over the years in the sector. And I find the people who work in the sectors I cover fascinating. The job they do is fascinating. The subject itself is fascinating. And so I spend a lot of time talking to people, a lot of time in email conversations, chat conversations with people. I have my sources who share information. And I just try and sort of take the pulse of the industry and sort of have that 50,000 foot view, while being in the detail, being far enough removed from the day job to actually be able to see and put together the trends, connect those sort of dots that are driving the industry in a certain direction. It's just something that I never knew I would be interested in, was sort of trying to identify where an industry is going next. But now I find it fascinating. And obviously I picked a very good time given the way the reinsurance industry has changed in the last 15 years. It's been sort of a complete transformation in the way companies are doing business, and something that's even beginning to accelerate now. And obviously the InsurTech wave came along at the perfect time for somebody like me, whose background has always been on the internet. Every job I've had has been online, or involved technology online. So I find insurers and reinsurers' struggles to adapt to technology fascinating to watch, because I've seen the travel industry go through that. I've seen the banking industry go through that. I've seen the retail industry. I remember when Amazon first launched, I was doing some consultancy for a competitor, at the time, a proper bookshop. And I can remember the board level discussions of what's going to happen to our business now that Amazon exists. And I think insurance and reinsurance is possibly on the cusp of having those discussions themselves when something else comes along.
Mm-hmm. So what is your staffing? What's the team of Artemis and Reinsurance News look like?
It's small. I have 2 full-time writers, some part-time people as well. And I have some people who help me out on the events front, because we now do 2 conferences a year as well, which is great and a lot of fun, but a lot of hard work too. And then a team of thousands of designers, developers, etc., who I'm gradually handing over the reins to, because up until 2 years ago, the entire website code base was managed personally by me. So it's nice now to be in a position where other people are looking after the things that I really should be letting go. So.
What is the name of the conferences, so we can put those on the show notes, because I'm assuming they're recurring, and where do they happen?
Yep, the next conference is July the 12th in Singapore. That is ILS Asia 2018, and that will be the 3rd annual conference in Singapore. And it's a great event, because Asia is obviously an area that looks closely at insurance-linked securities and catastrophe bonds, and activity there is relatively limited to a few really big cedents, but it's growing and the interest there is huge. The interest from investors there is also huge. So there's a real sort of twofold agenda with that event. One is education, and the other one is to ensure that people in the local region get to meet people from the mature ILS market. So being able to take great speakers from the industry out there to meet sort of local industry representatives is, I hope, valuable. And also it's proved to be a lot of fun as well, that event.
Yeah. What's the other one?
The other one's in February in New York. We just had our second one there, which we had just under 300 people attend, which was great. It's ILS NYC. 2019 will be the next one. I think 2nd of February 2019. And that is a more sort of a more thoughtful event, more thought-provoking, where we're quite careful in the curation of speakers to try and get people who are really interesting to speak on topics related to the future of the ILS business. So it's much more advanced in the sort of subject matter. But also, the has been very well received and resulted in really good conversations in the room and sort of afterwards as well. And everybody seems to enjoy the events, and I have a lot of fun putting them on despite being petrified for the couple of weeks before it.
Yeah, I bet. ILS has, when you had mentioned that, you know, there are going to be some hard conversations occurring at reinsurers and insurers as tech comes in. And I like to remind folks online that deal with quote-unquote disruption that we have already seen it in the insurance industry, and that's been because of ILS. ILS has completely disrupted how reinsurance business gets done, and it's put a lot of pressure on even the biggest of reinsurers and how they conduct business. Mm-hmm. What do you think, in now that you look back, you hinted at this a little bit, but what has made the ILS market so successful?
I think one was regulation. In fact, there's a number of factors. There's regulation because it was only the last 20 years that reinsurers and insurers have really been encouraged to diversify their sources of risk capital. And obviously this is the most diversified source that they can get and one of the largest pools available. The efficiency of the structures, the efficiency that the ILS funds operate under, the efficiency of their cost of capital, the fact some of the ILS fund managers are looking at measuring their business in a different way, more of an investment management approach plus loss costs compared to a corporation with global operations and thousands of employees looking at their expense ratio. There's a slightly different mentality sometimes between some of the financial, the way companies consider some of the financial metrics behind their businesses, which I think has led to a bit of a mismatch in terms of competition at times as well. But for me, it's a new way of taking risk out of the existing system, ensuring that companies are better protected. And that was one of the things I thought back in the late 90s when we first started looking at cat bonds in the ILS world was, this is going to actually protect the traditional companies and allow them to grow their businesses. This is going to allow them to go out and be more aggressive on the front end, writing risk, while safe in the knowledge they have access to the deepest and most liquid pool of capital available. It's only really the last year or two that companies have begun to say, we're using this as a tool for growth. We're using this as a second balance sheet. We're using this as a way to add efficiency to our own balance sheet by using a lower cost of capital in the capital markets. Obviously, some companies have been doing this for a long time, the likes of RenRe. Others are really still identifying the best business model for them. And I think that's just going to continue to change as some of the ILS funds move more in the direction of looking like nimble reinsurers, and some of the reinsurers move in the direction of looking like large and slower ILS fund managers. And there's going to be some kind of convergence in the middle, which will, that people will find a sweet spot where this stuff works alongside an equity balance sheet. But I don't think anybody's quite got there yet.
Yeah, we have seen that. So we have seen the likes of Nephila moving, inching closer and closer to the customer, setting up distribution mechanisms here in the States. I don't know how successful that has been, but we see that happening in both directions. Insurers or reinsurers moving closer to ILS and the other way. ILS has predominantly been a property market, and I think a lot of that has to do that with the fact that the catastrophe models that are used to create the metrics, used to quantify the risk and then priced those out have been property oriented. But now I, you know, going through your site, there's mention of cyber. There's mention potentially of other types of risks that we can pool in there, life, those, you know, longevity types of risks. Where is this going? If it needs to go in a particular direction, what are the key building blocks to get it to move in particular directions?
Oh, in terms of line of business, it's hard really, because people are doing a lot of different classes of business on a collateralized basis now. But they tend to be very specialist funds doing a few specialty lines or doing the odd terrorism deal or whatever it may be. And they have people who really understand these risks and they feel comfortable analyzing them themselves, pricing them themselves and underwriting them on their own. Obviously, as you said, the risk models have helped to drive adoption of the capital markets within insurance and reinsurance, because it has provided a third party view, which is all important really for a lot of the investor base. Particularly if you're a fund manager, you kind of need to be able to demonstrate that a lot of the risks within your portfolio have been through some sort of third party system for sanity checking them, etc. But I think going forwards, it's going to come down to how the sector puts its expertise to work. So we'll see gradual moves into different types of risks. But while the underlying insurance model remains as is and the reinsurance model remains as is, then really you're just collateralizing those agreements. So the expertise needed is significant. If there are further shifts in the future in how risk can be broken down into chunks, traded, etc., then we could see a much wider broadening of the asset class into different types of risks. I mean, again, 20-odd years ago, when we looked at the startup at things like online trading of weather derivatives and things like that, we were all discussing how someday we'll be able to break risks down into bite-sized chunks and investors will be able to soak them up and optimize their portfolios of risk on the fly, etc. And 20 years later, nothing is close to allowing that to happen yet. But there are interesting insurtech initiatives out there that are moving in those sorts of directions. There are open placement and trading platforms coming, which it will be very interesting to see how the market receives those versus the other initiatives for placement of risk into insurance and reinsurance markets, which tend to be driven by the industry. It's going to be interesting to see how those initiatives driven by technologists, investors from outside the industry get received.
I was hoping you would go in that direction. I am familiar with Will Dove and Extraordinary Re, that's trying to create tradable risk. And So you started an exchange. I think there have been various attempts to recreate that over time in the last 20 years. Can insurable risk be traded?
Absolutely. I mean, it already is through the secondary cat bond market. Essentially, when anybody takes a slip into Lloyd's and gets 10 syndicates to sign on it, they are breaking that contract down among the syndicates, depending on the quota they each get. That's trading. It's not electronic, but there's absolutely no reason that it can't be done electronically. My concerns for some of the initiatives looking at this are that you really do need to see sort of open platforms, I believe. I think a successful risk trading platform will be one that allows the entire market to use it. So whether you're an insurer, a reinsurer, a corporate risk manager, a investor looking for an insurance-linked investment, or a broker sitting between any of them, you can use that platform to make your life easier, your business more effective, to gain access to a greater amount of capital, or to put your capital to work in a more efficient way. I don't yet see anything coming that's going to solve all of those problems on the near-term horizon. There are some initiatives out there that will look to solve quite a lot of those issues. But at the moment, it does feel like we need to move through a number of sort of step changes in terms of how risk is traded electronically to get the industry to really buy into a more open exchange or auction-based platform, which I think is really where the industry needs to go.
Yeah. And you mentioned technology. So the two things that pop to my mind that I think seem immediately relevant to these types of markets would be blockchain and smart contracts and the combination of two. I am not in touch with the market as well as you have. Have there been attempts to try to implement those kinds of technologies in different types of ILS instruments?
There are some tentative steps being made. I guess the most notable would be a Swiss ILS fund manager called Solidum Partners, who have put the blockchain to use for the settlement of a private ILS deal, so essentially like a private cat bond. And they actually settled the transaction on a private blockchain that they had created. And then a couple of months later, one of the investors in another ILS fund actually traded some of that risk over that private blockchain. So, which is pretty groundbreaking to me, because that was the first ever securities trade on the blockchain, and it happened to come from the ILS market, which I find fascinating.
Absolutely. I could definitely see further efficiencies by implementing those kinds of technologies. So when you peer out in ILS, what do you see? Let me ask that in a couple of different ways. From a technological standpoint, what do you see that's coming up that might appear attractive, or have we discussed that already with blockchain and smart contracts?
Well, I don't think it necessarily has to be blockchain and smart contracts. I think trading technology, auction technology, technology that helps capital market investors to apply their capital to different types of risk in a programmatic manner. Those sorts of technologies, I think, could be really interesting for this sector. Blockchain is very, very slow. Very slow to use it. I don't think it's going to power trading platforms anytime soon. It could well be the plumbing that underpins them, that does the settlement between parties and things like that. Smart contracts very much could be insurance contracts in the future, and the oracles, as they call them, could be the triggers. Certainly is room for those technologies, but there's also room for people to create good technologies on other platforms. There are other databases out there that are far, far more performant and functional than the blockchain is at times, as somebody who's actually dabbled with it quite a lot. Yeah. Beyond that, in the ILS space, I see an increasing share of global catastrophe risk falling to the capital markets. I don't see that really slowing down. I see traditional companies increasing the amount of capital markets capacity they use. I think we will get to a time where the majority of reinsurance programs have an element of capital markets funding in there. Whether that comes via a traditional reinsurer who's essentially fronting for it, or using that instead of its own balance sheet. I think that for me, the main change that's coming is, and this is probably not that far off, is that big insurers and reinsurers really are going to have to work out their capital structure and work out whether having a massive equity-backed balance sheet is going to be as efficient as having a smaller one for their operational purposes, and then having access to deep pools of capital from institutional investors on a more direct basis. But I have one of my theories about where this is going is that insurers and reinsurers and brokers and everybody else in the risk transfer value chain, from the ultimate risk source of risk right through to the capital at the end, has to work out how they get paid for what they do. This industry has built up so much expertise. There are so many terribly smart people in this industry, and they all need to get paid, and companies need to work out how to manage to pay their staff, in a market where their margins are slimming, where their own balance sheet is maybe not the most efficient, and where there are competitors out there who are more nimble, have more of an appetite for risk, and in some cases can soak up a lot more of it because it's diversifying for their portfolios. So that to me suggests that traditional companies have to work out how to leverage the intellectual capital they've created, the expertise of their staff, and get paid for it. And that may end up being from fee-driven income rather than risk-bearing premium income.
Yeah, or a change to the business model itself.
Sure.
Beyond just risk transfer. Like you said, fee-based, but in a way that can take all of that intellectual property that they've developed internally. All of those really smart people, they know a lot. Mm-hmm. So why does the product just have to be a piece of paper with words on it? Why can't it be more than that? Because sure. I think companies and individuals themselves would pay more because the goal is more than just risk transfer, right? The goal is prevention or mitigation of risk ultimately. Risk transfer is just one element of risk management. So yeah. I really like where that's going, and I do hope it goes in that direction.
I think there's a huge job for the industry to do in terms of turning customers who begrudgingly accept a insurance contract for a year into a lifetime customer who wants to stick with them because they appreciate the service and they feel loved.
Yeah, I'm having an article published in a European publication. I think next week, by the time this podcast goes live, I'll put the link on the show notes. And when I was asked to write the article, it was to talk about innovation in insurance. And I said, before I can even get into innovation in insurance, we have to talk about the problem of insurance and why it's so difficult to innovate. Everyone kind of talks about, you know, lumbering companies and, you know, the inability to move forward or move into the future fast enough. Mm. But it's like what you said, to me, it all comes down to it's a product unlike any other. People begrudgingly, for the most part, buy it because they have to. Mm. It's sold, not bought, that type of thing. It's not a watch or a car or a sporting event. It's not something you can get right now. It's a promise. And what's a promise worth? It's hard to quantify, and people begrudgingly pay for that because you may not get your promise answered at the right moment. So anything that solves that abstracts the user from that they're buying an insurance policy, they're getting something else, they're getting something better, and not just the feel good at claims time, I think would be very valuable.
Sure.
I would like to end this recording by looking back at your last really 10 to 20 years at Artemis and Reinsurance News. Could you just talk about some of the highlights? You know, I think it's, you know, one of them has to be when, you know, that first company approached you for advertising, which really was the flag that, hey, this is there. I'm on to something here. But could we end the podcast on a really bright note and just talk about some of the positive things that have happened over the last 20 years that just make you really proud of what you have accomplished in your team?
Sure. Originally it was probably when we first launched Artemis, actually was a particularly proud moment because we'd taken a step into an area of the reinsurance market that was so new and so innovative that I would talk to senior underwriting officers from major global companies or Lloyd's syndicates or whatever, and they had no idea what ILS was. They'd never heard of catastrophe bonds, didn't know what it was, but they were fascinated by it. So that was nice and kind of gave me a bit of a warm glow that we were doing something interesting for the industry that the industry would benefit from at the time. When Artemis began to turn over some revenue under my ownership, that's obviously a big moment. But more recently, I would say the conferences have been a big learning curve for me because I'd never put on an international conference. Now five down and just working on my sixth at the moment. Pretty pleased with that. And the feeling of getting 300 really senior, really smart, and generally really nice people in a room to listen to a group of speakers you've put together, I think it's really rewarding. It's really rewarding to know that that adds value to people's years, and they will put it in their diary and they'll come again next year. And that really is a good feeling. Beyond that, I get wonderful feedback from really, really important people in the industry. I get emails from CEOs going, I really like what you said in that article. I also get emails from CEOs saying, don't agree with you at all. And one of the funniest things was I got a phone call once from a PA of a CEO of a very large reinsurance company in Europe. And she was really concerned because the button that allows you to generate a PDF off every article on Artemis had broken. And I hadn't kept the code up to date, or I'd broken the code, I think. And it had only been broken a few days. But she noticed, because every single article we write, she turns into a PDF, prints, and puts on the CEO's desk. And this is a very influential man in the industry. So things like that.
I will have to concur with that. Artemis is a very important source of information for me. It's the go-to source, as far as I'm concerned. If I'm doing any kind of research on ILS, I go to Artemis. I don't know anything else that even comes close to offering the wealth of information. So congratulations.
Thank you.
On your 2010, and 20 more years. Like, really, I look forward to, I would like for us to do this yearly so that we can get an update on the markets and what they're doing, because there's just no other place to go to get this information.
Sure, that would be fun. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff, and let's make it an annual chat.
I'll attend the event. If you can get something with the next New York City one, it's going to be a date. So, Steve, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations again, and cheers. Here's to another 20 years.
Thank you, Nick. My pleasure.
My guest this week has been Steve Evans of Artemis and Reinsurance News. Steve, thanks again.